session number 16808, Reel 5.
Reg Spittle's Reel 5.
Right. No, actually, so I was a driver mechanic by trade. That was my paid trade. But I'd become a troop corporal, tank commander, for about the last 2.5 years. And so when I was wounded the second time, as you might say, on the night of the 20th of July, I went into a hospital, and this hospital was simply a marquee in a hole in the ground. They dug a big oblong hole, put a marquee in, with only the roof above ground, and the soil was all banked round for shellfire or blast or whatever, you see. And all that we were sleeping on were actually stretchers with a palliasse on two blocks of wood to keep them suspended above the ground, you see. Quite crude, really, because I mean it was early days. And initially what they did, you went in, and then the nurses, I mean they got male orderlies, but they got women nurses who were in a grey uniform, and then they got a male doctor or doctors overall, you see. And what used to happen, initially they treated you, and then it got to the point where the sister would come round, and she would catalogue you as to your condition. And she used to come in and put a label on you if you'd got to go down what they said, the strip. And that was either you went back by boat or by plane to England, you see, because they felt that they couldn't contain your condition, you see. And this particular day, the nurse came down, the sister, and she looked at me board, and because she had another nurse with her who carried the boards, and as she got to each one, she gave her the clipboard, because it means they hadn't got a bed to hang them on the end, obviously. And she looked and she spoke to me, like, she said, right, she said, right, we'll send you down the strip. So they tied a label on me, you see. And just then, the male doctor came down. He said, how far have you got? And she's getting the boards, and he sort of backtracked on the people she'd already looked at. And they got to me, and he said, yes, yes. Right, he said, so off we go then. And he went to the next one and the next one, got about three down, farther past me, and they stopped. They were having a little bit of a huddle. And they came back to me, and this doctor, he said, you know, excuse me, Corporal, he said, what are you? So I said, driver mechanic, sir. Yes, that's what it says here, he said, but what are you? I said, I'm a tank commander. That's the reason, he said. No, he said, he's not to go. We've got to keep him. He said, I wondered about that. And apparently he'd had a message of some sort. And at that time, they started to keep tank commanders back instead of sending them back to England. Sort of assuming that they could deal with whatever their condition was, you see. And as I say, in these papers that I've got upstairs, when I appealed against this pension business and I sent all my medical records, it says there that I was to be returned to the unit with recommended for 14 days light duties, which was, they didn't want anybody there, like, you know, if you weren't fit for action, then they didn't want you. So I went back, and say in the way back, I collected this Cromwell tank from the tank delivery squadron with this young lieutenant. When they dumped me off at my unit during the night, Bill Bailey comes up, he was Air Tech Storm and dealt with all that. He said, he said, Red Spittle, 7892098. He was marvellous. He'd been Air Tech Storm ever since we terriers, you see. And he knew all us old, he knew all their numbers. He never forgot them, like, you see. He says, Red Spittle, he said, 7892098. Right, he said, you want a watch, a pair of binoculars, a new map board, he said, and like all the stuff that a tank commander needs, you see. And he kitted me out, as you might say. And he said, and he said, you can have your crew back. So I thought, that's nice. I thought, well, what's happened, like, you see? Because, so what had actually happened, I found out, was that prior to the regiment being going into Blue Coat proper, the 15 Scottish had had a bit of an action and they needed a few tanks. So they lent them a troop from A Squadron and a troop from B Squadron. I'll find out afterwards. What happened to B Squadron troop, I don't know. But my troop was wiped out in this skirmish, you see. I mean, we used to, at that time in Normandy, you were losing troops and half squadrons and almost the whole squadrons, and that was the normal procedure, you see. And, I mean, in Goodwood, we lost 52 tanks overall in 2 days. I mean, they were replaced with and all that, but we did lose 52 tanks. And so to lose a troop of tanks wasn't unusual, and it appears that my tank had been wiped out. Now, what I found out later was that Mr. Dolby, who was my troop officer in Goodwood, when after Goodwood, with losing 52 tanks, you can imagine there was a big displacement of casualties, and the colonel had rearranged all the tank crews throughout the regiment, so that when he got all the new replacements, who you classed as green troops, he evened them out amongst these so-called experienced troops, so that each squadron had an even number of tank troops with even green troops and experienced troops equal. So there was no one squadron stronger in experienced troops than the other, you see. And Mr. Dolby had gone to B Squadron. So a new officer had taken over my troop with Jack Mann, the troop sergeant. I wasn't there, and a young lad named Harvey Burrows had been given my job. He'd been made up to a troop corporal, and which emphasised what I was saying, that when he went there, he was an unpaid Lance Corporal wireless operator. He was now troop corporal of 2 Troop, A Squadron, with Jack Mann as troop sergeant, and an officer who I never knew. And they were ambushed or whatever. They were knocked out. The tanks were all knocked out. Now, Harvey Burrows was killed, who took my place. But my 4 crew members, because there was 5 in a crew of a Cromwell, had all got back safely. So Bill Bailey said, you can have your crew back. Which I did, you see. But Jack Mann, it turned out, had been taken prisoner. The troop officer had been killed, and there were other casualties, what I don't know. Well, coming back to my resolve not to become a troop sergeant, it must have been about 18 years after the war, and every year we have a dinner at Kettering, the 2nd Northants Yeomanry, apart from our regimental dinner, which we have at the Drill Hall in Northampton, which the association run, you see. Well, the 2nd line have a dinner of their own at Kettering every year, and I go every year to it, you see. This particular year, Jack Mann turned up. Well, he'd been living down the south of England, and of course in those years, people didn't have the transport to travel like they do now, you see. So a distance then was a sort of a unobtainable distance. Now it would be no problem, you see, but it did then. So he'd never been to the dinner before, and he turned up this particular year, about 18 years after the war. Naturally, we got talking, and I was interested to know what had happened to the troop and this, that and the other. And he finished up, when he was released, he was at Falling Bostall prisoner of war camp, apparently. And he'd lost about 4 stone in weight, because he said they didn't know what to do with him. And the Germans were trying to make sure they didn't get to catch up with the Russians. So they were marching him up and down the country to try and find Americans and British. And he lost about 4 stone in weight. Anyway, we were talking and reminiscing, you see, and about what of that and where did you get to and all that. Jack said, I said about troop corps. So he said, so you never had your strong? So I said, no, I said, I turned it down. So he said, what do you mean turned it down? So I explained all that, what I've told you, you see, the reason for it. He said, God, he said, I wish I'd have known that then. He said, although he said at the time, he said, I was pleased, because it meant, he said, we kept together, because we'd been together for about 18 months in the same troop, you see, and we were quite compatible, and you began to get to think, you could think what he's thinking before he told you, sort of thing. So we was quite happy in that respect. But it was here. He said, it was me that told Mr. Robson, who had been my original troop officer when we went to Normandy, he said, I told Mr. Robson, it's time you had your other stripe. He said, you were one of the old long-standing terriers. He said, you knew your job, he said, and you ought to be rewarded for it. He said, but then he said, of course, your name didn't go up. He said, and I'd got no reason to wonder why. He said, I just assumed Mr. Robson hadn't put your name forward, you see. In fact, he had, but Tom chucked it out. And so, and I said, but the thing was, Jack, I said, by the time Tom sent him up the second time, I said, I made my own mind up that I was safer as a troop corporal, most times being in the front, under my own thinking, than being a troop sergeant behind a corporal who probably wasn't efficient. I said, that's what I thought. He said, well, it's funny you should say that, Reg. He said, because that night we got duffed up, he said, I got young Harvey Burrows in front. He said, the troop officer at the back. He said, and I'd stopped him twice. He said, he was pressing on almost recklessly. He said, and I'd stopped him twice. He said, and I got to the point, I was thinking of stopping him again, he said, and we was right in it, he said, and the balloon went up, he said, and we'd had it. He said, and I've said to my wife after the war, and we used to be talking about things, he said, I told her, I said, if Red Spittles had been there, it wouldn't have happened. He wouldn't have got so far forward without realising the situation as what we did that night. I said, well, that's more or less what I was thinking. That was my thinking, which might not have been correct, but that was an example that Jack said that really confirmed my thoughts of having become what you might call experienced.
If we can go back to your chronology, to go back to 1942,
yeah,
because you were then talking about being at Brandon, and I understand that you then moved from West Suffolk to Wiltshire.
From East Anglia down to Wiltshire, yeah. Right, well, before we go down to Wiltshire, to Ogbourne St George, I feel that I should refer back to certain items and incidents that happened that seems quite important. One being that they decided that with the morale of the country after Dunkirk being quite low, as the authorities thought, that something ought to be done to be publicised, and at that time they had formed the 1st Army Division, and the 6th Army Division, which was a mailed fist, and we'd got these new tanks which were Valentines, and the whole division was equipped with these Valentine tanks, which had a great publicity in the press under the heading of killer tanks. Well, they might have been at the time, because they were smallish infantry tanks equipped with a 2-pounder. But for the publicity, they decided we should have a King's inspection on Lakenheath. And at that time, there were two brigades, armoured brigades, in a division, which was rather a big clumsy thing altogether. And so we were taken out to Thetford Heath, and we had some amusing incidents, because funny things do happen even in wartime. And we were parked up under some pine trees so that we weren't observed from the air by the Germans and all that sort of thing. And we cleaned the tanks all down and got them all ready for repainting. We repainted them up in all the posh camouflage colours and everything, you see. And retired that night in our bivvies. I got up the next morning to find that all the pine needles had fallen off the pine trees and smothered the tanks in all these pine needles, which made really good camouflage. But they weren't shiny anymore, you see. So we then had to get neat petrol and wash all the old paint off and the pine needles and everything, and rig up the camouflage nets over the top of each tank, laying on the nets the tarpaulins that we would normally cover the tanks with to prevent any more pine needles falling down on top of the tanks after we'd painted them. although no one was going to look into them, the insides had to be immaculate. So in those days, in the early days, we used to use aluminium paint. Later on, with the things not being so handy, we started to use flat paint because aluminium paint was not available, you see. And the only thing was that you painted the inside, and eventually you finished up with the floor, which you were standing on to paint everything else. So what we used to do was get the littlest man in the troop and the biggest man in the troop, and the biggest man in the troop would hold the littlest man in the troop by his ankles and lower him down to paint the last piece of the floor. The littlest man used to be a lad named Ted Heath, and he was taken prisoner by the Germans, and whatever they did with him, I do not know, because he was a right character. But that was Ken's punishment for being the smallest man in the troop. Anyway, we had this inspection, and you can imagine the size of it. It took a couple of days to get them spread out, and about 360 tanks all spread out in lines right across Thetford Heath. And then we had the inspection. And of course, they couldn't walk along the lines, it was too massive. So there was the King and the Queen and everybody else, and Churchill and all the dignitaries from who'd been kicked out of their countries and come here for safety. And they were all in these white half tracks that I got the lease land from America. And they just simply motored down the front of the lines of these tanks, you see. And we must have stretched for miles across Thetford Heath. But anyway, having had the inspection and a little bit of spiel over some loudspeakers, a bit of Bolstrop air morale, by which time you'd imagine we were chock-a-block and fed up to the teeth, having stood there for hours. And they then had to motor from the area of the tanks down to the road to go, you see. And so they formed up in a sort of a convoy. And they wanted the public to see on the television, well, the films, as it were, those days, all the crowds of tank crews waving the entourage away as they drove down the road back to the main road. So what they did, they obviously hadn't got enough people available to line the whole route from where the tanks were to the road. So they had people running, red caps and that, and after the convoy had gone by, you were supposed to run across the road, run past the other side, the unseen side, back across the road, so it looked as though you had a continuity of hundreds of tank crews all the way down, lining the road, all the way from the tanks to the main road. I don't know what the authorities thought about that, but it was quite comical. I did it a couple of times. I got fed up and I thought, well, that's it, I'm running no more. So I wandered back to the tanks. But just one of the comical things that happened. And then, of course, from Brandon proper, we had a winter camp there. We were in Nissenhuts. And I've been to Brandon, through Brandon, once since the war. And I think there's still a couple of them left. I think it's a timber yard part of it now. But at that time, it used to be about a mile outside of Brandon town proper. And in the summer, when the spring came, we moved out to a row of trees, apparently, which is supposed to be 20 miles long, called Duke's Ride. And they have these rides all over England, where I suppose the nobility used to gallop down with the horses or whatever. And we spent the early part of the summer there, prior to going down to Wiltshire. And the funny thing there, normally now I suppose we'd be shot at if we threatened to go in those areas now, because they would all be fenced off. But when we first got up there, it was all these ferns and that, and with Valentine tanks, which were not very big, the driver was looking at along the top of the ferns, almost level with his eyesight. And so he had no knowledge of what was in front of him, other than the fact he saw these ferns which kept going down in front of him, almost like sea waves, really. And what there was all over the area were these flint knappers' quarries. And these flint knappers, they used to have these quarries, dig them in like a wedge of earth. They'd just start digging. When they got to where the flint was, they'd start to dig, and you finished up with a wedge of earth being removed. And at the far end, where it gradually sloped down to, you'd probably have a drop of about 25 to 30 feet, with sloping sides corresponding starting from nothing down to a wall at the bottom of soil about 25-30 feet deep. Well, of course, in the ferns, even the tank commanders had a job to see them until they were too late, and it would be unpleasant to have a drop of a tank tumbling in something like that. So the first, well, appeared to be several weeks, they fetched some pit props from somewhere, and at that time we hadn't got jerry cans that the Germans were using. We were still using the old British petrol cans, which were pretty useless because they used to leak, they were very frail. And to get the petrol out, you had a pushed in lid, as it might be termed. It was only about 3 inches across. You just drove your pickhead in and scooped it out and then poured the petrol out. And it held about 4 gallons. But as I say, they leaked very badly, so you could have a lorry come up with full of petrol and probably only be half of it would be petrol, and the other half had all leaked away. And so what they did, they knocked a hole in the empty ones, and we put them on, not these pit props in, on the corners of these quarries, and then put the tin over the top and a 4-inch nail to secure it, and then painted them red. So all over the area, you'd see these tins painted red sticking above the ferns so that the drivers and the tank commanders could spot these quarries. And as they were located, I mean, initially they went out walking parties, trying to spread out across the country in walking parties. And after the initial findings, you still found odd ones, so they had to be reported and dealt with a lot, you know. But that was something we had to do when we got there. And then, of course, there was Brighton May's match factory. Their plantations were out there, so they all had to be dealt with. We had to fence those all off so that tanks didn't go into the woods and knock all their match trees about. And there we are, sort of fighting a war sort of thing, you know. But anyway, it all, I suppose, had to be done. And then we had another incident happen as time was going on, and we had these freak weather at times, and they decided to make a film, a publicity film, you see. Well, we had got these Valentines, which were an infantry tank, and they only did about 16 miles an hour, quite slow, because they had to go at a walking pace of a man. And at that time, in Northampton, they had the 9th Armoured Division stationed around Northampton, and they had Covenanters, which were cruisers, which you could do up to about 45, 50 miles an hour, and look very impressive, dashing about, you see. And they're going to make this publicity film. So the camera crews came out, and for several couple of weeks, we had to do what they told us, be in certain positions for the angles of the cameras coming over the brow or coming through the woods and all that sort of thing to satisfy the publicity boys. Well, of course, the Covenanters were going to be the British, and we were going to be the Germans, you see. And it was the first time that I saw any captured German equipment as regards clothing. And anyway, those people that were going to be seen, tank commanders and such, would be wearing Africa Corps caps and tunics. And on the tanks were, of course, the big black cross representing the Germans with a white outline. And the Covenanters were prominently British, of course. Well, they got everything ready, and they did preliminary shots till the camera crews were all quite happy about it. And they said, right, tomorrow we're going to do it. So that was that. And we woke up the next morning, and it had snowed. The idea was that it was going to be desert, because areas of Thetford Heath are very much like the desert. There's bags of dust and dirt, and not always ferns, so you get quite some large flat areas where there are no ferns, you see. And it was going to be a desert propaganda thing, but when they got up in the morning it had snowed, so of course us lads thought, oh, that's tated it. But it didn't. They simply whitewashed us and carried on, and we did it anyway. So what the outcome of it was, I never saw it on the pictures anywhere, so what they did I don't know, but I suppose it became in Russia instead of in the desert. But one of the comical things that happened that we did. As I say, and then we had another amusing incident while we're on amusing things. They used to take us out when we were in between Cambridge and around Cherry Hinton and Stoke Quay and the villages at Wilbraham and all that, where the troops were all stationed around these little villages. And of course, we were a few miles from Thetford Heath. And we only drove up once on our own tracks, up through Bury St Edmunds to get for the Heath. And we ruined the town centre, because at that time, I don't know about now, you had to go up the town, a sharp right turn and then a sharp left turn. And with battle tracks, they ruin a tarmac surface like nobody's business. And I do believe when we finished, they've more or less made trenches on these turns where they'd skid turn the tanks. But we went up there, and we was up there for about 14 days, living on our own rations and sort of thing, and enjoying it like by skates, because you hadn't got your sort of parental control telling you what to do. And at the end of the period, 10 days or a fortnight, whatever it was, they decided that they would have transporters to take us back. And they got all these scammels lined up along the road, these scammel transporters, and everybody was going up. Well, the whole time we were there, right in the middle, in the open, was a tree that was died. It was an old tree that had died, and it just stood there, not very tall, no leaves on it, and just derelict. And all the way through, I mean, it's temptation to a chap in a tank, if he sees something like that, he thinks, well, I should knock it down. And Bobby Peel, our major, he gave strict instructions, when we leave, I want that tree to still be standing, you see, knowing the encouragement it would be to knock it down. Well, when we were coming off the Heath, at that time, Tiffy Harris, who became a troop sergeant later, he was at that time a troop corporal, and his driver was a chap named Jock Shearsby, and they decided, Tiffy did, because he was a bit of a lad, they'd knock it down, and they were almost the last tank coming off the area. Well, what happens in sandy soil, the roots of these pine trees stretch out for miles underground because of the need to search for moisture and also to get a grip to keep the tree up. Whereas a normal tree doesn't, his roots don't probably go very far, but in that sort of soil they go for yards and yards out. Anyway, Tippy decided to push it over, and he did. And they went up, and they gently pushed this tree, and it went over. But what happened, what they hadn't anticipated, the roots stretching out so far, and the tank not being a terrifically large one in weight, the roots came up and lifted the tank off the ground and suspended it with both tracks off the ground, which meant the tank was isolated, you see. And the obvious thing was that somebody had gone and put a rope on and pull it off, like you see. But when the word went up, Bobby Peel, he was a bit of a lad, old Bobby, he said, no, let the bugger stay. He said, if he hasn't got any rations, he'll bloody starve. So they left him, and we all returned back to where we'd come from, down around Cambridge way, and left poor old Tiffy up there, stranded on the roots of this tree. But after 48 hours, they decided to go and rescue him and fetch him in. But one of our standing jokes amongst the squadron that went Tiffy up the tree down. And another funny incident, when we came off the Heath and to go to Brandon, to get down onto the road, there was two gate posts, be almost a foot square, each, stood on the track. Well, there's no need to go down the track. I mean, you go right, so there's no fence, just the two posts from a long distant gateway of some sort. And the Valentines used to just go through with a few inches to spare. A driver's always like a challenge, you see, so they always used to deliberately come down the track to go through these two gate posts. And at this time, I was a driver for a Sergeant Fred Tilley, who's still alive, he lived down St James. And old Fred, even to this day, when we have a bit of an utter under the phone, he still remembers it. And we came down, and without thinking, we deliberately got on the track to go through the gateposts, completely forgetting that they'd decided to put sand shields on the side of the tank, you see. It was something that we was just an experiment with. And but when we put these sand shields on, of course it made the tank that much wider, which we totally forgot. And Fred said afterwards, he said, I realised what was going to happen, he said, but I was that amazed and astonished, he said, I didn't say nothing. But I, not thinking, I was a driver, not thinking about the sand shields, drove down straight.